Welcome to The Bridge, the official podcast for the University of Maryland Baltimore School of Pharmacy Patients Program. The Patients Program is the bridge between the community and researchers. The Patients Program created this partnership to help researchers listen to the community's voice in order to build a bridge to an effective learning healthcare community. Here's your host, Rodney Elliott.
Hello, everyone. I'm Rodney Elliott, the Community Engagement Specialist at the Patients Program. I want you to take a listen to this panel discussion on race and racism in digital health and information. It's led by 2022 PPA graduate Gerard Chalot. Hear how distinguished leaders in the digital health and information technology space talk about ways to improve a system that can benefit marginalized communities.
For this year's Summer Roundtable series, our theme is Asterisk, or Addressing Systemic and Structural Racism to Improve Safety, Quality, and Trustworthiness in Health Delivery Systems. Our first session today is about race and racism in digital health and information technology. And I couldn't imagine a better moderator and host for today's discussion, Gerard Chalot, a graduate from our 2022 Patients Professors Academy and the CEO of ID Heaney. And with that, Gerard, I turn it over to you.
Thanks, Hillary. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us for this important discussion on race and racism in digital health and information technology. We're fortunate to have with us today an esteemed panel of experts who bring diverse and insightful perspectives to this topic. I'm going to briefly introduce our panelists. Avrielle Epps Darling, a PhD candidate at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. Katie Shilton, Associate Professor at the University of Maryland College Park. Andrew G. Parker, Associate Professor at Georgia Tech, and Lauren Wilcox, Senior Staff Research Scientist at Google. We will start by inviting each panelist to share a bit about their work and perspectives on our topic. Each panelist will have roughly 5 minutes. Avrielle, let's begin with you.
Great, thank you so much, everyone. I'm really looking forward to hearing from the rest of the panelists today. So I'll start us off by just talking briefly about my work. I look at how structural racism and race are embedded in algorithmic systems broadly, but that also includes digital health systems, and how that intersects with kind of a full range of identities, identity aspects like gender, sexuality, class, socioeconomic status, etc. I particularly focus on adolescent development and the importance of understanding racism and its impacts on adolescent development really cannot be overstated.
Hi, I'm Katie Shilton. I'm an associate professor at the University of Maryland. And my research has broadly been in tech and data ethics. And specifically, in the last few years, I've been leading a project called the Pervade Project, which is focused on research ethics. So I'm interested in this space, particularly in digital health research, and advising researchers on sort of how to think through ethical challenges with using digital data sets and computationally available data for things like machine learning, but also, you know, for making clinical decisions or making research, new knowledge discovery, right? One of the primary things that has come up in that during that process in that space are people's concerns about the uses of the biases that are baked into their data and the ways that those biases are going to appear in decision-making through machine learning or new knowledge creation through digital health. And so thinking a lot about race as one lens of critiquing data.
Andrea?
So my work is really at the intersection of public health and human-computer interaction. And I have done work focused on health equity for almost 2 decades now, which is crazy. But most of my work has focused on thinking about how technology can improve the well-being of racial and ethnic minority groups, primarily a lot of work with Black and African American populations. And I do community-based research to try to envision future technologies with communities to think about how technology can help them overcome disproportionate barriers to well-being, and also engage with those barriers directly through things like health activism.
I'm Lauren Wilcox, and I manage a team in Google Research in our responsible AI and human-centered technology organization. We're a multidisciplinary research team, and our mission is to critically examine and shape the social and technical processes that underpin and surround AI technologies. And so we aim to do this through participatory and culturally inclusive and intersectional equity-oriented approaches that that strive to center impacted communities. I want to first also kind of call out that since we're being asked to share our perspectives, I want to acknowledge the positionality of my perspective as a white woman, and that I can't fully understand the lived experiences of racism. I think it's just important to call that out, that imbues my perspective with a certain degree of societal privilege. So I'm here to actively listen and learn and participate in supporting processes of change. I think an important part of that is discussions like the one we're having today about racism that can encourage people to take action to address systemic inequities and discrimination, but I kind of just want to call out my positionality here.
So as you can all see, this is a powerhouse of a panel. They demonstrate, and I was just writing these notes as you were talking, is that from adolescent education, data bias, public health and health equity, and responsive AI, but using both a psychological/mental health approach, research approach, an asset-based local and global vision, with as well as the most important part, I think, that ties all this together, is simply listening to understand and to have empathy. So with that said, let's move on to our discussion. We want to know, I'm sure our audience wants to know, how does racial and gender bias manifest in the digital health and IT domains? And what are the implications on health outcomes for marginalized communities?
I can start. So of course there's so much to say.
Right.
I think one thing that we have found is, you know, bias in terms of populations studied in the research domain. So there's, of course, so much digital health innovation happening commercially, so many products being created and so much research happening. But often that work is not being done with an explicit focus on racial and ethnic inequities. We're like doing this project looking at promoting mental health in perinatal women using technology. And as we've been reviewing the literature, you know, various interventions that have been developed, but overwhelmingly those interventions have been only evaluated with white and Asian participants. And so we know very little about the populations that most experience maternal mental health inequity challenges, Black and Latinx populations. So like just that, you know, the fact that the populations that are experiencing the inequities are not being included in studies means that necessarily our empirical research is biased. We lack an understanding of, like, even though we're creating these things, are they actually appropriate for and going to be impactful for all racial and ethnic groups? And so I think that's an issue. We see sort of reification of existing problems in digital systems. One example of that is we know that, like, mental health screeners, they've been critiqued for not being culturally sensitive to, for example, assess the particular kinds of race-based stressors that Black women face. And so then when we use those same screeners in digital health tools, we're sort of perpetuating that ineffectiveness in screening. And so, you know, we could be unintentionally creating bias systems in that way as well.
Now, I'm interested to hear what Katie would say with regards to data bias in those scenarios.
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of data bias comes in with exactly the things that Andrea was talking about, right? Like, and so that's one huge, you know, or a whole set of huge sources of data bias. So I'll talk a little bit about, so one of the distinctions I think it's useful to think with in this space is created data versus like found data. Found data isn't a great word for it, but data that already exists due to digital interaction versus clinical data or data from, you know, new interactions with people. And so I think sometimes researchers have, you know, they're like, well, you know, we have problems of underrepresentation with our lab data or with our survey data. So we'll turn to digital data because it is more objective somehow. It has better coverage, right? And that's not always true. And so I think, you know, asking researchers to be equally as critical of digital device data. So, you know, we'll turn to Twitter and we'll study Twitter. We'll study, you know, people's, tweets about, and look for mental health characteristics, and we'll study Black Twitter, and then but that is leaving out huge population, you know, segments of populations, right? And so like that who uses Twitter is like a tiny percentage of the US or the world population, right? So digital devices introduce a whole other set of biases in addition to these pervasive historical biases that are present in our sort of created data, right? Anytime we're dealing with found data, with data that was created for a commercial purpose or another purpose, we are dealing with possible exclusion. We're dealing with problems of representation. So I mentioned this a little bit in the beginning, but it can be very challenging to properly represent categories like race or gender when we're dealing with data that we've scraped, right, from websites or from Facebook or from Twitter. Twitter is like the model organism; it gets used all the time. But you know, social scientists and health scientists are trying to infer race frequently or infer gender, and that can be a pretty challenging way to do it. Also, you know, digital data forces you into binaries a lot of the time that may or may not work well. So I think, you know, my whole message is researchers have to be super critical of this imported found data, right? Of scraped data, of digital device data, because it was not necessarily created with research in mind, and it was not necessarily created with just research outcomes. It was not created with just research outcomes in mind, right? That is not what this data was created for. So as researchers, we have to do all of this extra work to try to attend to that.
I want to add on to that. I think it's important, obviously, to have the discussion around data, and it's a critical piece of where bias manifests. But I think something that is underrepresented in these kinds of conversations is also the model decisions that are made when we're building models. So I think a lot about, like, you know, when I was learning how to be a data scientist, how I was taught to think about optimization functions and like what are appropriate optimization metrics. And even in a universe where we have underrepresented populations within the data, we could still make choices to prioritize accuracy, for example, for the underrepresented population, and sacrifice some accuracy for kind of like the larger mainstream population. And those choices just aren't being made because the choices that are being made reflect the values and the biases of the individuals who are writing the code. And so, you know, I always try to challenge the idea that like the data is biased because it reflects a racist and a sexist world, and therefore we kind of have to throw up our hands, because actually we have lots of options available to us, lots of choices we could make that would require us to sacrifice these tools working well for the people who assume they are always going to work well for, in service of a more equitable you know, reality where they work well for the most marginalized people in the population.
That's a great segue, Ariel, to our next question is, what are the key ethical considerations when designing these digital health technologies, especially ensuring that they are inclusive and representative of all racial and ethnic groups?
The ethical considerations, you know, everyone's going to disagree on this, obviously, or maybe not everyone in this panel, but like everyone broadly is going to disagree on this, because we are coming at the question from very different perspectives. So I can talk for myself. I think as like somebody who identifies politically as an abolitionist and somebody who identifies as, you know, not a reformist of these systems. I think the ethical consideration or the ethical blueprint that we follow is one that like forces us to rethink all of the systems that are interacting with each other to produce these inequities, rather than just say, okay, let's tinker over here at the search algorithm, and then we can tinker over here at the way that we collect the data, and then we can tinker over here with the way that we like partner between academia and industry. And you know, those are all necessary components, but they're insufficient in totality, in my opinion. I don't think that there are necessarily technological solutions, though technologists must be involved in the process and the practice of abolishing systems that no longer work for everyone and imagining new ones that place marginalized folks at the center.
So after hearing that, Lauren, like what are your thoughts? Like what ethical considerations when you're designing are some of the components that Avriel spoke of included? Are they actually put into the system?
Yeah, I think a lot of what Avriel mentioned resonates kind of what I've seen on the ground in development environments, where there's one of the big ethical challenges for us is mitigating the risk that people are wrong about benefits they think a technology will bring, or misunderstanding a problem we think a technology or a model or an algorithm will solve, because this also has cascading impacts, right? And effects. So we have to be careful about how we mitigate that risk as well. So if we just say, well, we'll mitigate the risk by like validating it, let's make sure we're right, and we'll bring in a community to do that work for us, right? That also has ethical challenges, because when we abstract a problem from a context and extract data from communities without reciprocal benefit to them, also we risk eroding trust and creating mismatches between what's actually useful and valuable versus what the technology does. And this can lead to, of course, further disparities, right, in use of systems and benefits that provide or perpetuate a status quo, or versus like actually delivering on the promises of innovation. So that's one, I think that's a real challenge that we're facing right now.
And you know, I'm gonna ask you, Katie, you know, because you have the data, right? So, and you see the bias, like what would be some considerations when designing based on the bias that you see in the data?
Sarita Emmerich has this really nice phrase of, she calls this attunement, that researchers many researchers currently lack, but we are actively working on developing forms of attunement for researchers that part of being, and so Avriel's comment about like the choices that are made in model development and like the ways that data science has been taught in the past that have not emphasized ethical choices as part and parcel of technical work, right? But we are moving, I hope, into an educational space where that is what we are actively trying to teach data scientists, like you need to attune to social issues, right? You need to attune to racism, you need to attune to gender, you need to attune to historical marginalization, because it will impact the choices you make in your data. And then you need to have an ethical standpoint about what kinds of system you're going to build. And so that, I think Avriel was like demonstrating that really nicely. Like I think we need data scientists to know, like, are they reformists? Are they abolitionists? Are they, and that's not a conversation they are having right now, right? Broadly. I don't want to call out all data scientists. Many data scientists are having this conversation, right? But like, it's not something that we have taught students to do. And we need to be able to do that. Like we need to be partnering with area studies on campus. We need to be partnering with social science and, you know, traditions in sociology that have taught students how to do this, right? And anthropology and other disciplines who know how to do this. Data science needs to partner with those folks so that our students have an ethical point of view and have a perspective and realize how it impacts their work, that it, part and parcel of technical work is making really hard social choices and because they are building social systems. So yeah, I would say it's really about attunement and trying to figure out how best to prepare our students to do that.
Of course, we have to go to our designer who actually does this. Please, Andrea.
Yeah, I so appreciate everything that's been said and just Katie's last point about, you know, sort of teaching our students that, you know, ethics is not just that like required course that you just like think is going to be an easy A and that you just do and then move on from that. It's just got to be just central to everything that you're doing. I just feel like we have so much more work to do there. trying to figure out how to equitably engage communities in the entire design process, the entire process of, you know, future envisioning technologies, thinking about what they should look like, evaluating whether or not they're meeting community needs. We talk about this is like central to human computer interaction research. But, you know, and we're always talking about how can we more equitably engage communities? And there's so many barriers to that. The communities that we're trying to quote unquote serve, we need to actually figure out how to do that better. So, you know, of course, we don't want to design anything for these populations without them. So we need to do that. Also, I think, you know, when we talk about like racial and ethnic disparities, there's a tendency to treat groups as a monolith. Of course, there's so much variation within racial and ethnic groups. You know, like a public health mainstay is like there's actually, you know, so much more variation even within races than between races. And it just sort of like, just thinking about that from the perspective of like, okay, if we're saying that we're going to, for example, address Black maternal health, like we have to consider, okay, how does that vary depending on where people live, depending on, you know, their gender identity, depending on their socioeconomic status, those sort of key, you know, traditional identities that so we sort of think about, but also just like, you know, we're looking at using this framework, the Superwoman schema framework, which is a lot of research has talked about as, you know, okay, this is this identity that a lot of Black women sort of identify with in this sort of need to be project strength, and how doing assuming this identity can be both helpful for mental health and detrimental to mental health. But actually, like, you know, not every Black woman subscribes to this identity, and there are different parts of it, and you know, the different levels of subscription to it. So even, you know, thinking about frameworks like that have been used to help take a sort of like intersectional look at, for example, mental health inequities in this population, we have to, you know, sort of not just uncritically adopt them, but sort of say like, okay, well, let's understand to what extent within this population we see variation in terms of adoption of it. So I think, you know, not treating groups as a monolith is important. And then just the last thing I love, Tiffany Vino has, you know, this paper with her colleagues on intervention generated inequalities, which I think is just so great. I like always have my students read it, and it just lays out these like four different ways in which technologies can deliberately or inadvertently further or create health inequities through unequal access. You know, if we create tools that are not accessible to all populations, through unequal uptake. So even though people can access them, they just don't use them to the same degree. Unequal adherence. So they start using them, but they are not engaging with them to the same degree. And then like unequal effectiveness. So using them, everybody's using them, but they're working better for some groups than another. And I think just that sort of like having those four ways in which thinking about systems that we design can actually cause further inequities in mind.
So what approaches have been most effective in combating racial and ethnic bias in digital health and IT? And more importantly, what lessons can we learn from these examples?
Efforts to lessen racial inequities in technologies in general, I think, have mostly fallen short as I've observed them.
So what have you observed?
Just in terms of like mainstream efforts to lessen racial bias in, you know, kind of large scale algorithmic systems. I've seen a lot of teams try to, you know, do what both Andrea and Lauren have talked about in terms of centering community participation and participatory research and participatory development. And I think those efforts are valiant. I think that is definitely the road that needs to be traveled to get to any place that we're all kind of talking about we need to get to. I don't think technologists are going to solve these technology problems on our own. Unfortunately, I think they require a larger political will that has to kind of emanate across all sectors of society to combat the deeply entrenched power systems that ultimately prevent the work from happening. I mean, I have conversations with folks across industry all the time that who are working in fairness and ethics and trust and safety and all of those kinds of teams. They're just like, we just, as much as we want to get this work done, we like actually can't, because ultimately the work is in opposition to the goals of the institution and the organization. Even if they're not, you know, they're not saying that outwardly, but like internally, that seems to be a pattern that I'm recognizing. So, and that other folks that I'm talking to are recognizing. And I think that highlights the need for decolonial, anti-capitalist approaches. I know Katie mentioned this earlier, and I'm really interested to hear what she thinks. But I'm wondering if I constantly am wondering if it's possible to solve these problems in the current socio-political economic system that academic institutions, corporations, et cetera, all exist in.
It's interesting because this is there's a similar conversation happening in another community I spent a lot of time in, which is the sort of privacy scholarship community, in that, you know, lots of people were working on privacy when the problem was capitalism, right? The problem is capitalism and data capitalism, right? And surveillance capitalism. And so, and you now see that community working really hard to connect privacy, this sort of smaller issue, to much bigger civil liberties and justice issues, right? That privacy is a piece of an infrastructure for protecting larger civil rights and justice. And I think that in the design and sort of, and so now moving into health and health disparities, that like that, well, health researchers, many health researchers have known that for a while, right? That this is a larger civil rights conversation. But researchers, I think, frequently do, and then Lauren may be able to speak to this or not, I'm not sure, to some degree, like feel stuck in these institutions that reward capitalism, including academic institutions, right? And like, I mean, your stories about, you know, you're like being able to pay participants equitably, right, is like absolutely a problem. And like, our IRBs are set up to make that difficult and things like that, right? Like we have all of these incentives that are against us and against doing very radical work. And so what do we do? And then that's like where I start to get worried and like, all right, well, I look to where I have power, which is students, right? Like I can talk to students and I can try and shake things in my institution, and that's like kind of right. So, and the, like, I think, right, so how do we have this larger social and political conversation? And, you know, given the context of democracy in this country right now, how do we be effective, right? Like, how do we, and so looking towards the places where we do have influence, I get worried about this. I will say, though, in my like eternal annoying optimism, that the conversation here has changed so much just in the course of my not that long career, right? Like, I've only been doing this for 10 or 15 years. And like, the conversation around technologists and their responsibility and accountability, and data scientists and their responsibility and accountability for race and racism, has gone from like, what, we just build tools, to, oh yeah, right, well, you need to be paying attention to this, right? And that's just that big shift is encouraging to me. Like, this conversation's gotten easier to have. My students are engaged, you know, like they absolutely care about these issues. So in terms of a timeline, like, it's not immediate. We have a long, 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 long way to go.
Yeah. I mean, I want to build on that optimism, because I think I'm also, you know, for better or for worse, an optimist, but I agree. I mean, there are tons of challenges. I do see, though, efforts of embedding equity thinking and cultural humility, and even that alone, creating space for conversations about equity in technology development, has, I think, goes a long way in starting to enable reflexivity. And so we're at the very beginning, but I do see it happening, and I see people who are very committed to this. And I've been one of those people that, you know, produced research results that I knew would probably shut down a project, and they did, and I was fine with that. And it meant that, okay, my project's canceled. I don't have a project. Now I have to go and find a project to work on for my own livelihood. But you know, I see people doing that, and people were supportive in that process, and I found allies who helped me through that. And so I'm encouraged that those experiences and opportunities are there now.
So looking ahead, what strategies should digital health and IT sectors adopt to create more racially inclusive and equitable technologies?
I would love to see more investment in research on algorithmic auditing, evaluation of models and new technologies that bring in communities in ways that are beneficial to them as well, and don't waste their time, and provide mutual benefit. I would love to see moving more broadly to earning community trust, but also thinking more broadly about what it means to rebuild trust generally, and then show that input is being acted on, right? That there are research agendas and investment in things like explainability, transparency, accountability, a greater focus on how information is accessed and delivered to people. And then translating results of that to actual outcomes and iterative processes and development to do better in technology development. So those are some things that I think could help. Continuing to fund roles like chief health equity officer at technology companies, you know, that build out teams, that have resources to build out teams. Ivor Horn has a health equity team at Google, who, you know, they work across product and research to bring health equity perspectives to bear on decisions that teams have to make. And I think that's been really instrumental in helping with some of the reflexivity that we've been talking about, and helping people understand what should factor into decision making, you know, at different stages. I also think it's helpful to, I wish we could sort of rethink about investment in consumer digital health technologies. So there's a lot of investment in designing for like individuals, you know, your experience, your watch, your personal, you know, health tracker, and their personal intervention. I think there's a cultural norm of kind of self-determinative approaches and kind of helping one care for oneself. And I think that diverts attention from coordinated community-oriented solutions and addressing structural barriers, because it sort of casts fixing a problem as a consumer technology that someone can act, you know, just purchase off the shelf.
Can I just build on that? Because Lauren, you know, you're speaking my language. I'm like, yes, yes, yes. that was my first point that I was gonna make. I mean, especially when we're talking about health inequities specifically, not just like health promotion, there's so much work showing that we will never reduce inequities if we don't create solutions that address social and structural determinants, that solutions that are collective, that are community-based in nature, are more effective than these individual focus solutions, because the factors that are creating these inequities are social, cultural, structural in nature. So yeah, so we need to have that kind of approach, which, as you said, Lauren, is counter to what we see predominantly being created. And I think like in our work, we've just found so much value in partnering with community organizations and thinking and creating tools that amplify what they're doing, because, as you know, you guys were mentioning even earlier on, technology alone is not going to solve all of these issues. And so community organizations are doing a lot of the work. They're doing the work of trying to create healthier environments, of bringing access to resources, of, you know, being a trusted entity that people can go to for information, for support, etc. So you know, it just makes sense, but a lot of the digital technology innovation has looked primarily to hospitals, I think, and which we need innovation there too, but there's this like untapped resource of the community organizations that are actually caring for people and trying to care for people in the 99% of their life when they're not in the hospital. And so there's just so much opportunity to really amplify the work that those organizations are doing.
Thank you all for this discussion. I mean, I'm sure that this everyone, this audience definitely got a lot out of it. What is a realistic time frame for mitigating and addressing race and racism in digital health and IT?
How soon can you join the revolution? That's my question.
That's it. How can we improve the transparency of digital health technology? Let me go a little bit further on it. AI is a big issue and people recognize it has potential to improve care, but there is not enough transparency of how it's used.
Yeah, there are a lot of things I think that could be done. I'm just going to highlight one because I think it has come up before, and that's data and model documentation. And so, one of the challenges with these tools is understanding how they were trained, what data was used, how things like race or gender were represented, if at all, and then what model choices were made, right? What does this model prioritize and why? And, one of the challenges of many learning technologies is that they go from a context and then the context disappears, right? There's this decontexting that happens when the data moves around and when the data flows through models and outcomes come out. And the more we can do to build that context back in, the better transparency we will have.
I'm encouraged by all the conversations recently in this year specifically about just widespread AI literacy and data literacy. I think there needs to be a public outreach effort to include AI literacy and data literacy into like every level of education. And that means not only within schooling, but also within cultural forms of communication so that they meet people at the level of storytelling and imagination.
No, that's excellent because there's a question here that's asked, is there or should there be an equity or health equity toolbox for digital technology developers to help them stay on track? Is that something that's being developed at the industry side, industry end?
Yeah, I think so. I want to echo something that Avriel said. It's necessary, not sufficient, in terms of solutions. So I do think having an if we're thinking about a toolbox in terms of helping developers understand, how to do a disaggregated analysis where they can, look at different performance of a model for subgroups and understand where there might be discrepancies. Maybe look at data, regenerate a data set to be more representative. We certainly need tools to do all of those things. We also can't rely on tools that are just sort of focused on the machine learning pipeline without understanding things like how are cultural differences of annotators of this data factoring into how they're labeling this data, things like this, right? There's all the types of the social stuff around it that we need to better understand. And then also, what problem are we trying to solve in the first place?
So as we wrap up, I want to thank our panelists for their time and insights and to the audience for your engaging questions. We've explored many facets of race and racism in digital health and IT, and I hope we can all walk away with a better understanding of these issues and the potential strategies for creating a more inclusive and equitable digital health environment.
If you want to learn and listen to more roundtable discussions from 2023 or even last year's 2022 roundtable discussion series, go to YouTube, search for the Patience Program. And you know what? While you're there, be sure to like, subscribe, and share our page with your networks.
Thank you for listening to the Bridge Podcast. To learn more about the Patience Program, visit our website at www.patience.umaryland.edu.